All right. Good morning, everyone. It's my great pleasure to introduce our keynote speaker for this morning, Hadley Wickham. I'm not sure he really needs an introduction to an audience like this, but I think he's famous for a package or two that he recently got on Cram. Hadley's been extremely prolific at writing a whole bunch of tools to improve the data science stack and also the software development stack for the rest of us. And today Hadley's going to talk about some of his tools around data ingest and functional programming and his plans for the future of ggviz, or as I like to call it, the life-changing magic of the Hadleyverse.
Thanks, Kartik. So I kind of want to let you down. I don't want to let you down gently. I'm not going to show you a single interactive graphic today. But what I am going to talk about is some of the things that I'm thinking about as we sort of move towards a grammar of interactive graphics. And in particular, I want to sort of talk about this idea of tidy tools. Like, how do you create tools that fit together to give you a seamless workflow that just like gets out of your way and lets you do data analysis? And so I think of this as this sort of idea as not just like how do you write functions that work together within a package, but how do you write functions that work across packages? How do you write a system of packages that all work together, and hopefully not just packages by one person, but by packages by lots and lots of people? And so today I'm going to talk about this idea of kind of tidy tools for data science. And I think it's worth revising, as I do in pretty much every single talk I've ever given, what do I think the key tools for data science are? And I think there really are like six key tools. So first of all, you've got to start by importing your data. You've got to get your data out of whatever crazy file format it currently is in, whether it's an Excel spreadsheet or a database or a CSV or from a web API. You've got to get that into R. If you can't get it into R, you can't do anything. I mean, obviously you can use other tools, but who cares about those? Then I think it's really important to get your data into what I call a tidy form. So the details of this aren't sort of super important. The key idea is that you want to store your data in a consistent and a uniform way, so that every time you do a data analysis, you structure your data the same way. That means you can have tools that work with it, and you're not kind of constantly fighting to get the output of one function to the input of another function. Then you'll often do some transformation. You'll create new variables. You'll create summaries. And then, to me, there are two main engines of data discovery, which are visualization and modeling. So visualization is like fundamentally a human activity. Visualizations are great because they can surprise you. They can help you refine your questions of the data. But the problem with visualizations is because they're a human activity, they fundamentally don't scale. Like, as you get more variables, as you get more data, you cannot look at every possible visualization. So to me, the complementary tool to visualization is modeling. And to me, like, modeling, this is statistical modeling, this is machine learning, data mining, whatever. But whenever you can make a question sufficiently precise that you can answer it with a numerical summary or compute it with some sort of algorithm, I think of that as a model. And models are kind of fundamentally computational. The computer does it for you, and that means that they scale much, much better. The problem with models, however, is that every model has to make assumptions, and a model by its very nature cannot question those assumptions. So to me, that makes visualization surprises you, but it doesn't scale. Models can kind of never fundamentally surprise you because they can't question their own assumptions, but they do scale. So any real analysis is going to require you iterating between these tools again and again and again. You might start with a scatter plot. You fit a model to that, you transform the data, look at the residuals, and so on and so forth. And then finally, at some point, you know, if a data analysis falls in the forest and no one is there to hear it, doesn't make a sound, well, no. At some point, you need to communicate your results to someone who is going to make a decision, typically based on your work. And I think that's really important. That's a really, really important part of the data analysis. You'll have spent hours or days or weeks potentially on this. You'll have gone all down all these dead ends. Now you're going to wrap that up into some linear explanation that other people can actually follow. And one thing I think it's really important to think about here is that when you're thinking about tools that work together as a system, it's not just the individual tools, it's how they fit together. It's the glue. And I really like this quote by Hal Albison, who's a pretty famous computer scientist. So really the point is, like, it's easy when you look at this diagram to focus on these verbs, on these words, but I think equally it's really, really important to think about the arrows. How do they connect together? Because if they connect together seamlessly, you can kind of fall into the flow of data analysis and everything just works and it's beautiful and lovely. In other words, what I want to do is create a pit of success. Like, I don't want like a pinnacle of success where you've got to like strive and climb to get to it. I want you to just kind of like fall into being successful. And to me, there really are kind of two key ideas here that make kind of functions fit together nicely. And the first one, these ideas are both ideas about uniformity, which is Rick Becker talked about yesterday. Like, this is kind of one of the key ideas that made S so successful early on, this idea of providing a uniform interface. And so first of all, you need like some sort of uniform data structure. So I really like this idea of tidy data. There really are like two basic principles to tidy data. First of all, you put your data in a data frame, and secondly, you put the variables in the columns, right? This is a really, I think, really simple idea. There's some details into how you actually do that, but if you do this, if you consistently put your data in a data frame and you make sure each variable is in a column, you will kind of naturally find that R is easier to work with. Now, not every single type of data fits into that format. Not everything is most naturally stored as a data frame. Jeff Leek has a really nice blog post about kind of tidy data and other types of tidy data like matrices, but maybe you might have vectors or dates or XML or strings or whatever. The key idea, the most important thing is this uniformity, this consistency that within a package, if the functions all kind of stick to the same type of data, your life is much, much easier. Now, there are some challenges because sometimes you have a mix of different types of things. So, for example, imagine you're going to do some cross-validation. So you have some training data that's basically a data frame. You have some test data that is also a data frame. You're going to fit a model, say a linear model. You're going to generate some predictions, which are a vector. And then you're going to compute the root mean squared error, which is a scalar. And when you're doing cross-validation, you might be doing this like hundreds of times, potentially. Right, or maybe you're doing bootstrap estimates of something, which is a very, very similar process. So you've got all these related things. How do you keep them together? How do you put them in a data frame when they're things that you typically don't find in a data frame? And I think there's one really useful and powerful idea of one powerful way of using data frames, and that is to have columns of a data frame that are lists. Now, this is like a totally legitimate thing to do. The definition of a data frame is a data frame is a list of vectors, and each vector has the same length. A list is a vector, so that's okay. And you can put anything in R inside a list. And so that means you can put anything inside a data frame. I'm going to talk about this idea a little bit fairly briefly. I think it's a really powerful and useful idea. So if you were going to model that kind of cross-validation example, this is perhaps what your data frame might look like. You've got a column of training data. Well, here these aren't actually data frames because it turns out you've got like one original data frame, and then you've got all these resamples of it where you can just think of these resamples as integer vectors, right? You don't have to store this complete sample data every time. So I've got a little special S3 class for that. I've got some IDs, which is useful when you start to do plots. I've got a list of linear models, and then I've got the root mean squared error for each of these, the model applied to the test data set. Unfortunately, base R doesn't make working with list columns easy. If you try and create a list column with data.frame, basically base R treats lists as lists of columns. If you want to treat it as kind of a list of rows, then you need to surround it in I. So instead, we're going to use Tibble. How many of you heard of the Tibble package before? Okay, so I'll talk a little bit about it. I'm going to tell you very shortly, in brief, and I'll explain on this more and shortly. Tibbles are lazy, surly data frames. And I'll talk about why you want a data frame like that. But here we're going to use data underscore frame, and you're going to see we're just going to create a very simple data frame. It's got two rows. It's got one column called X. That's a list. The first element is an integer vector of length 2, and the second element is an integer vector of length 3. So before I talk more about tibbles, I want to give you guys a little quiz on your R skills. So I'm going to give you I'm going to give you 30 seconds. I want you to talk this over with your neighbor. What is this code going to return? You've got 30 seconds starting now. Okay, time's up. Does anyone, so there's two surprising things that happens here. So first of all, like, what is this going to return? What column of the data frame is this going to return? It's going to return the XYZ column, right? Because R uses partial matching with data frames as a convenience. If you've got a very long variable name, you can just enter the unique prefix. And then secondly, what type of column is it going to return? It's going to return a factor. So there are two surprises here, right? First of all, we've got partial name matching. And secondly, we have the infamous strings as factors equals true default. Now, both of these things are there for good reason. And I want to talk about that a little bit. I don't want to, like, there's absolutely legitimate reasons that data frames behave this way, even though now that seems a little bit surprising. And I think there's really two important tensions that you should be aware of if you want us to understand R code. The first thing is that R is not just a programming language. R is also an environment for doing interactive data analysis. And when you're doing interactive data analysis, it's nice if the tool kind of helps you out a little bit. When you start doing more programming, that's a little bit, some you don't want it to be helpful, you just wanted to throw an error straight away. But generally, like, base R tends to be pretty heavily on the interactive side. It's not just a programming language. And that is something that confuses a lot of people about R and makes them think, oh, R is like crazy and stupid. No, it's not. It's not just a programming language. It's also an interactive environment. The other tension is sort of like between being conservative, either like, do you want old code? Like, everyone makes mistakes, right? I make mistakes all the time. Now, what happens when you discover you make a mistake? Like, should you, like, burn it all down and start from scratch and do the right thing? Or should you kind of say, well, I made a mistake, but let's kind of, you know, keep, let's preserve that behavior because lots of people are relying on it. And so base R tends to be, like, pretty conservative. And that is really, really great because it means, like, if you've written base R code, like, from 10 years ago, the chances are it will still work and it will still work in 10 years' time. Now, obviously, like, I'm more on the utopian side of things, which is like, you know, there's like one little problem, like screw it, burn it all down, we'll start from scratch. So there's obviously like pros and cons to each approach, right? Conservatives, your code is gonna keep working for a long amount of time, but you're kind of trapped into early mistakes. Utopians, obviously, I think things get better in the long run if you actually get there, but and through analogy to utopian societies, you don't actually always end up at that utopia. So tibbles are basically kind of a data frame that is both lazy, so it does as little as possible, and it's surly, so it complains a lot. So this is the same code with tibbles. So I created a tibble just using data underscore frame because obviously, hopefully, as you know, I like underscores. If you extract this variable from it, you'll get a character vector back. It never, data underscore frame never changes the type. And if we extract a single column using a single square bracket, it always returns a data frame. And if we try and extract a column that does not exist, it throws an error, right? So tibbles are lazy and surly. And I believe that is actually helpful to be lazy and surly because that's going to force you to confront any problems as soon as possible. Like the one thing that Tibbles do that is actually more useful, I think, is they have a better print method. And again, this print method is a bit about, it's kind of lazy, right? It prints a lot less. It's only going to print the first 10 rows and all the columns it fits on screen. But I think one thing that is really useful is it also prints the type of each column, which is particularly useful at picking up if you've accidentally got a factor where you expect a character. So I'm going to show you a little demo of list columns. I'm going to kind of work through this cross-validation example I just showed you in a little bit more detail. So I'm doing this using the modelr package, which is just on GitHub. It's kind of experimental, but it's there if you want to play with it. So I'm going to generate this. I have this kind of true model. You know, normally as a scientist or someone doing data analysis, you don't have the privilege of knowing what the truth is. Here we do. It's just a line, basically, with intercept 1 and slope 2 and some random variation. So I'm going to make a data frame of that, and then I'm going to plot it just so you can see what it looks like. And now I'm going to fit an overly complicated model to this data. I'm going to fit a polynomial with 8 degrees of freedom. So I'm just going to do that. This is all pretty much base R code or code you're familiar with already. Now, I think one technique when you're trying to visualize a model or understand a model, it's really useful to generate a grid of values and then compute all the predictions for those. So tidyR gives you an easy way to kind of generate that grid. So here I'm just generating an evenly spaced grid across the X. This is a really, really simple case, right? There's only one one predictor variable here, so the grid is just one-dimensional. That's really simple. And then I'm going to use this add predictions function, which is from modelr. This is basically just a wrapper around the predict function, which instead of returning a vector of predictions, adds a new column to your data frame. So that predictions, right, it's a really simple data frame, two columns, and it's easier to see that if I overlay it on that plot. Right, so this is, you know, if you're have any kind of background on statistics or thinking about things, this is clearly like a really bad model, right? It's excessively complicated. You're not going to expect it to generalize well to new data sets. But how can you kind of make that? But if you look at like the root mean squared error, like as a measure of the model quality, like it's pretty small. This model fits this data really well. But how can you kind of like generalize that to what's going to happen when you have new data? And one way to do that is to do cross-validation. And so cross-validation, you're basically just going to take out randomly 10% of the data, you're going to fit the model to the other 90%, and then you're going to check how well did that model fit the data that wasn't used to fit the model. Like, obviously, it's cheating if you use the same data to both fit the model and to evaluate the model. And cross-validation is just sort of a simple way to escape that conundrum. So I'm going to generate 100 cross-validation samples, so that's going to give me, for each sample, I get a training vector. That's just basically the row indices that have been selected, and a test, and then just some kind of unique ID, which we're going to use for plotting a little bit later. Now I'm going to use some tools from PER. I'm just kind of showing you the ideas here. Don't expect to like take any new knowledge away from this in particular. I want you to get the idea like of what a list column is and why you might want to care about it. And at the end, I'll point you to some resources if you want to learn more about how to use these. But basically what I'm going to do is I'm going to fit a model to every of these training data sets, and then I'm going to evaluate that model by computing the root mean squared error. And the root mean squared error needs two things to compute it. It needs a model and it needs a data set. So I'm going to compute that, add it to the data frame, and now I have this data frame that you saw earlier. So what I can do is, here I'm just doing a little quick plot of what the root mean squared error looks across all of those cross-validation samples. So this, it's a little hard to see, but there's a white line here. That's the value from the model when we use the same data to fit the model and to assess the model. That's our assessment. You can see when we use different data to assess the model and fit the model, that's excessively optimistic, right? We get lots and lots of pretty bad models. And one thing that's nice about this approach is because we still have the original test and training splits, we can see, well, why do we get such bad ones? So I'm going to say, give me all of the cross-validation samples that have a root mean squared error that's greater than 5. Then I'm going to unnest them. I'm basically going to extract the original data back, and then I'm going to plot them. So on the x-axis, I have the values of x that were sampled to go in the training data set. And on the y-axis, I've just got the model identifiers. So can you spot what all of these test sets have in common? You might notice they're either missing, they don't have the first data point, or they don't have the last data point. And that's one reason why we don't use polynomials with 8 degrees of freedom in models, and generally you want to avoid polynomials altogether, because polynomials are like, they're very wiggly, that's fine. The biggest drawback of a polynomial is they shoot off to positive or negative infinity very, very rapidly, which means they generally do a terrible job of extrapolating outside the range of your data. So they're great for interpolating, but terrible for extrapolating. Okay. Now I wanted to show you like another example that's a little bit, this is sort of, why do I care about list columns, and why am I talking about this in a session that's towards interactive grammar of interactive graphics. I wanted to show you like a slightly different motivating example for why list columns might be useful for visualization. And here I'm going to show you some data from the USA boundaries package by Lincoln Mullen. This is a really cool package. It has the boundaries of states in the US, not just for today, but for every year since the beginning of the US, basically. So I'm pulling out the boundaries of the states as they were on the January 1st, 1820. So I can look at this thing. So one thing, you'd never want to print an SP object because it prints out all the stuff. But we can say, well, like, this is an SP object. This is a spatial polygons data frame, and that means there's basically two things in here. We've got the polygons, which give us the boundaries of each state, and then we've got a data frame that has some additional metadata about those states. So I'm going to extract that, I'm going to extract those borders into just a kind of a regular data frame, just to kind of help you understand what is a map, what is a polygon. Well, a polygon is really just a sequence of longitude and latitude points, and you draw a map by drawing a line that connects those. So I can take this, and I can draw a map of the US as it looked in 1820, which obviously is a little different than today. So that's one type of data in this object. We've got the data about the shape of the polygons. We've got some other data there, which is some metadata. We've got data about each of those polygons. So we've got, for example, Alabama, the Arkansas Territory, Connecticut, Delaware, the Florida, unincorporated. I don't even know what that means, unorganized FT. I have no idea about US history, but... We've got some interesting data here. I've got some interesting metadata. Now assume, like, I know what this column means, and I want to display it on my plot. How do you do that with ggplot2? Well, basically, you have to do a join. What I'm going to do is I'm going to take this data frame, which represents the polygons, and I'm going to join it to the data frame that has the metadata. And then I can plot that and say, I'm going to fill it by the territory type, and now you can see, like, I've succeeded in my goal, right? I've colored the states based on the type of territory that they are. But what does this data frame look like? Well, if I look at it, you'll see basically what I've had to do is I've had to repeat the metadata about the polygon, like this is Alabama and it's a state that was founded in 1819 on December 14th, and I had to repeat that for every single corner of that polygon. And that's obviously quite inefficient. And that's one reason that drawing maps in ggplot2 tends to be a little slow. So one thing we could do instead is do something like a list column. We now, instead of having one row per corner of the polygon, I can imagine having one row per polygon. And so now the latitude and longitude are not single values, but they are vectors. And I think this way of thinking about these kind of more complicated compound objects like polygons, I think is really, really useful and is going to kind of eventually emerge in what I'm calling the GGGeom package, which is going to provide some data structures and tools for dealing with the geometric objects that underlie visualizations. Okay. So that was uniform data structures. So the principles of tidy data are, if you can put your data in a data frame, you should. If your data is in a data frame, then each column should be a variable. If that doesn't work, well, you can use, just be consistent, be uniform, and be aware that you can use list columns to store more complex object types in the columns of a data frame. So that was the first point. The second point I want to talk about is not like what thing you pass between functions, like the data frame or the vector or whatever, but how the functions themselves work. You also want uniform APIs. You want the functions to basically kind of work in the same way. And so I'm going to calling this now the idea of tidy tools. So tidy data is a philosophy for storing data. Tidy tools is a philosophy for writing functions that work together naturally. And there are three pretty, well, two of the principles are pretty simple, and one of them is a little esoteric. But the first one is, when you write a function, the goal of the function should basically be to take a single step towards your goal. In other words, each function should do one thing and it should do it well. A function should be specialized and simple and easy to understand. But of course, like to do a real data analysis, you don't just take one step, you've got to take lots and lots of steps. So you also need some consistent way of combining those simple steps. And that is, I'm going to hopefully convince you, the pipe. And then finally, you want to support referential transparency, which I do not have a good way of, I do not have a snappy name for this, but I'll attempt to explain that to you and show you why you should care. Okay, so the idea of this, of writing simple functions, is this, I think, really good way of attacking complex problems. And a really good way of attacking a complex problem is to take simple pieces, to take simple uniform pieces and combine them together. Like, one place in the real world where this has been really successful is the idea of a container, right? It does not matter what is in this container, but you can stack them all together on a container ship and ship them around the world. You've provided this sort of uniform interface over whatever is inside this. And so this is what your function should be like. The function itself might be really, really complicated inside, but it should expose a simple uniform interface to the world. Another way of thinking about this is you want your function to be like Legos, right? Each Lego block individually is very simple. You can pick one up, you can understand what it does in isolation, but you can still create very, very complex things by combining them together in creative ways. And there's one principle, I think, that's really important. There's lots of ways to make sure there's lots of ways to not have a simple function, but I think there's one that's particularly important, and that's this idea of impure functions, which is a technical term from computer science. So a function is called pure if it satisfies two criteria. So firstly, if its output depends only on its input, and secondly, it makes no changes to the state of the world. So I'm going to give you another challenge. You've got 1 minute. I want you to brainstorm with your neighbors what common R functions are impure. So you have 1 minute, starting now. Okay, time's up. Does anyone want to yell out one function that they believe is impure?
R.
What was that? R. Oh. Okay, so par maybe is what you're saying? Well, so setting graphic parameters, right? That doesn't do anything, it just changes the state of the world. Plot, that's another great one. Like, plot doesn't return anything. You're calling it purely for its side effect of printing, of displaying something. So those are both functions that basically violate condition number two, right? They make no, these functions are impure because they change the state of the world in some way. What's a function in R whose output does not depend only on its inputs? So get working directory, that's a really obvious one, right? There's no arguments, and yet it's going to return different values. There's another function similar to that, right? Like, every time you call it, you get a different answer. Or any of the random generators, right? Random generator would not be very useful if it returned the same random numbers every single time. So the point is not, like, impure functions are really, really, really useful. There's lots and lots of them. Another, right, read.csv, any file reading function, the argument just gives the path, but the contents of that file might be different. So these functions are impure. And any function that saves out the disk or changes the options or loads a package even, these are changing the state of the world. And so the goal is not, like, these impure functions are really, really important, but they are harder to reason about because you can't understand them in isolation, right? You can't understand them because depending on things outside in the world, they might change what they do. So it makes them harder to kind of understand and reason about. So the goal is not to, like, eliminate your use of these functions because if you did, you would not be able to do data analysis. The goal is to make sure when you write a function, you isolate it. So I think a function should either be, like, called primarily for its side effects. It should either be impure and proud of it, or it should be pure. And I had to look, like, really, really hard to find a function in base R. So generally, all the functions in base R follow this principle. I looked really, really hard, and I couldn't find one, but David Robinson mentioned one in his talk, and that is if you print out the summary of a linear model, you will see this p-value. And you cannot, that p-value is not stored in this object in any way. It's just computed when it's printed out. And this is frustrating, right? Because you can't program with that. It's only printed out. It's not returned in a data structure, which makes it frustrating to work with. Another example that's closer to home, if you use geomSmooth in ggplot2, like, this is called mainly to add, like, a nice smooth line to the plot. But what do you do if you want to actually access the coordinates of that line? What if you want to compute on them? What if you want to do something else with them? Well, you're out of luck. You can't. So one of the other things that I'm working on, or will be working on more, is this package called ggstat. And the idea of ggstat is to pull out all of the computations that ggplot2 does for visualization. This is ranging from things that seem really complicated, like smoothing, to things that seem really simple, like binning histograms, which the more I learn about histograms, the more complicated they seem to get. But the idea of ggstat is to just pull these out into functions. If you want to transform your data in the same way that ggplot2 or ggviz would, you can call these functions directly. The other point of this package is to feature much, much better performance. One challenge of doing interactive graphics is that if you want an interactive graphic, it's got to update like 30 times a second. Now, ggplot2 like updates more like once every 5 seconds. So that means you need like an order of magnitude speed improvement to get true interactivity. And a lot of there's a lot of computation that ggplot2 does behind the scenes that makes it slow. The goal of ggstat is to both separate that out so you can use it however you like and be much, much faster. So the next principle is that you should compose these simple steps, these uniform pieces in a consistent way. And I think this of the nice analogy here is that the goal of your functions are to be atoms, and the goal of the pipe is to be like the standard molecular bond. And when you've got atoms plus molecular bonds, you can create molecules of arbitrary complexity. So how many of you have known about the pipe or read about the pipe before? About half. So if you haven't heard of it, I'm going to illustrate it with a little story about a little bunny named Fufu. So little bunny Fufu hopped through the forest, scooped up a field mouse, and then bopped it on the head. And I've written the sequence of actions as if they were function calls. And this style of writing is a little hard to read, right? Because you've got to read it, first of all, kind of from inside out, from right to left, which is kind of backwards if you're reading in English. And the arguments to each function can end up spread far apart. So the idea of the pipe is to kind of allow you to keep writing these simple functions, which you can easily read about, but to provide a way that allows you to compose them in a way that is optimized for humans, that's easier to read. And if we use the pipe, we can just write, little bunny foo-foo hops through the forest, scoops up a field mouse, and then bops it on the head. So why is the pipe useful? Well, it's designed for humans. The goal of the pipe, from our perspective, it couldn't care less. The goal of this pipe is to make it easier for you to read your code. And I think that is really, really important. Donald Knuth kind of alluded to this yesterday when he said like he looked at code that he'd written like 3 years ago, and if he hadn't written it with linear programming, wouldn't be able to understand it. That like when I look at code that I've written 3 months ago, I'm like, that's written by, did I write that? Was it a complete stranger? Was it an insane complete stranger who wrote that? So I think writing code that you can understand is really, really important. And I think this, like thinking about designing interfaces for humans, not just computers, is really, really important. The other thing that's great, I think, about the pipe is that it's completely optional. If you don't like the pipe, you don't have to use it. You can still just use that underlying functional interface. You can compose functions however you like. You're not forced into using the pipe. And the really nice thing about it is that it gives this consistent interface across packages. And I'm going to illustrate the benefits of that consistency by talking about the state of the world. Now, we're here, I'm just doing a little combining a little dplyr and a little ggplot2, and you know, pipe, oh, and now it's ggplot2, and I'm going to use a plus to compose things. So there's a lot of benefits to having a consistent way of combining pieces. You don't want to be in the situation where one package combines pieces with pluses, one combines them with the pipe, and you've got to like think, oh, which system does this package use? And even ggplot2 itself is not consistent, because like you think, well, I'm going to create a plot, I'm going to add a layer of points, I'm going to add a line, and then I'm going to save it. That does not work. Instead, ggsave is just kind of like a regular function, so you've got to wrap it around the outside. Now, one sort of interesting historical note is that ggplot1 actually had a tidier API than ggplot2. So here's some ggplot1 code. This was originally called ggplot, but I renamed it to, I've kind of brought the package back to life so you can try it out if you want. This is mostly for historical interest, but you can use it. This is some ggplot1 code. You'll see you create a plot by composing functions. And the cool thing about it is that you can rewrite that to use a pipe, and you get syntax that is as readable as ggplot2. So if I had kind of discovered the pipe when I was writing ggplot, there never would have been a ggplot2. And this is what it looks like. And you can see, well, not much has changed since ggplot1 in terms of printing scatterplots. And if you've used ggviz just uses the natural thing. It works, has the same idea as ggplot1, as dplyr. You compose complex objects by composing functions. You create complex objects by composing functions. But what's this weird guy? And this brings me to my third and most poorly explained principle that I think is really important, and that's this idea of referential transparency, which is another computer science term. So both ggplot2 and dplyr make heavy use of non-standard evaluation. And that means basically, like here, when you're talking about MPG, this variable in this data set, unlike the normal rules in R, R doesn't like try and figure out what the value of that is straight away. It doesn't try and figure out the value until you actually plot it. Or when you're using deep filter from dplyr and you mention the cylinder variable, well, it looks first in empty cars. It looks for a variable in this data frame. It doesn't look for an object in the global environment. And this is really great for interactive exploration. Filter like subset and base R is fantastic if you have very data frames with very long names, because you don't have to repeat the name of the data frame again and again and again. But it comes at a cost. You can't use the usual rules to create a function that uses these functions. So you can't kind of extract out this and assign it to a variable. That's not going to work because there's no variable called, there's no object called cylinder. So that makes dplyr great for interactive use, but as soon as you want to try and write a function, it's really painful. And that's because of this idea of referential transparency. And basically the idea of referential transparency, and this definition is shamelessly cribbed from Wikipedia, is basically if your code is referentially transparent, you can replace any expression with a variable. And that's really important because my sort of rule of thumb is whenever you copy and paste code more than three times, you should create a function. So code like this is okay, but as soon as you've copied and pasted it one more time, now is the time to write a function. This is obviously like a heuristic, right? It's not like a global truth. But once you get too many copies, it's worth the investment to write a function. And how do you write a function? Well, typically what you do is just kind of, instead of using specific values, you rename them to like generic values, you make sure that works, and then you wrap it inside a function. And you cannot do that without referential transparency. So if you have code like this, right, where 90% of each of these three plots are the same, we have ggplot, we have a data frame, we have some aesthetics, and we add on a point, and we add on a smooth. The only thing that changes is the data frame and the variables. So you might be tempted to apply that same principle and create a function like this called scatterplot, which takes data frame as an argument and the x and y variables. And if you try and call it like this, it's not going to work because ggplot2 is going to say, oh, you want to plot the x and the y variables. It can't figure out that you want the weight and the MPG variables. So this violation of referential transparency makes it hard to reduce the duplication of your code when you're using dplyr or ggplot2 or any other function that makes use of non-standard evaluation. So one thing I've been working on to make this easier is the idea, instead of just kind of magically doing non-standard evaluation, is to be explicit about it, is to use a formula instead. So you're familiar with formulas from linear models and all sorts of other models, but they turn out to be a really general and useful tool in R because they capture both the code and the environment in which that code should be evaluated without actually doing the evaluation. And that means you can save them as an object and say, well, now I want to pass that object to a function. So you can write functions using the same tools you already have. And in the future, there's sort of going to be like a templating system built in, so you can say, well, replace the value of variable with cylinder, so you can kind of not just reuse code exactly as it is, but make little templated snippets of code, kind of like very, very lightweight functions, and then replace those in your own code. If you'd like to learn more about this, this is something I'm still kind of working on. If you did not understand my not very good explanation, that is totally to be expected, and I will be working on explaining that better in the future, and in general, like giving you better tools so that when you recognize that your dplyr code is duplicated or your ggplot2 code is duplicated, that you can figure out easily how to turn that into a function. It's powered by the lazy eval package, and if you are interested, you can read about, I've got a little description about how this works on RPubs. Don't worry, you don't need to take photos of any of these URLs. If you try and do, there'll be a slide at the end with everything you need to know. So I just wanted to finish up. So again, my goal is to help you fall into a pit of success. And the way I'm trying to do that is by giving you tools that work together well. And the goal of what I'm working on now, it is not very exciting, like cool interactive graphics. I want to work on this infrastructure so all of these packages work together seamlessly. The goal is to have lazy eval so you can apply these principles of referential transparency in any package that I've written, and hopefully other people will think this is a good approach as well. And then using these packages like ggstat and ggGeom to improve the performance of both ggplot2 and ggviz. The other thing I wanted to mention is this phrase that I cannot bring myself to say because I think it is so egotistical for me to say it, but I would like to propose an alternative, and that is to think of this as the tidyverse. So the tidyverse are functions that have tidy APIs and have tidy data frames. One reason I don't like this name is that it's not just about me, that there are lots and lots of people contributing and I think this idea of that's like the that is the best keynote animation I have ever done, I believe. So think of like if the goal of the tidyverse is to have packages that work together seamlessly. I should mention all of these kind of bullet points are aspirational, like my packages don't follow these bullet points currently, but the goal is to work over time, to have this consistent, uniform interface. So once you've learned the tools in one package, it's trivial to combine them with tools from other packages. So the tidyverse is tidy data and tidy APIs. Before I get to this slide, actually, I just wanted to put a brief plug in for the R Consortium. How many of you have heard of the R Consortium already? Okay, that is awesome. The goal of the R Consortium is basically to, I'm just going to say this frankly, it's going to take money from companies that make a lot of money from R and invest it back into the R community. The goal is to help companies who are like building businesses on top of R to give back to the R community. So there's two things I would like to tell you about the R community. So first of all, if you have projects that you think will benefit the R community broadly, we have grants available. The grants are closing on July 10, so you still have time. But broadly, we're looking at, we want to fund projects that make the R community better for lots and lots of people. And we also have a system for doing working groups, for building consensus around maybe where projects, things don't need money, but they need consensus would be really, really useful. And if you'd like to help us, well, first of all, if your company is making lots of money based on your use of R, you should encourage them to give back by joining the R Consortium. But also, you know, just tell us your problems. We want to know what R could do better and what are problems that lots and lots of people are having. So to finish off, I just wanted to go over the key points that I covered today. So the two ideas, tidy data and tidy tools. In tidy data, put your data in a data frame and then make sure each variable goes in a column. If you'd like to learn more about this, I have a couple of chapters in the R for Data Science book that I'm writing with Garrett Grohlmund, one on tidy data and then one on list columns if you'd like to learn more about that. On the flip side, on the tidy API side, three basic principles. When writing a function, you want it to take one step towards your goal. You want it to be as simple as possible. And then you want to combine those many simple pieces using function composition or using the pipe. And then finally, you want to think about this idea of referential transparency. If you do use non-standard evaluation, think about it carefully because it breaks this property and it's going to make it harder for people to write functions that use your code. Again, if you'd like to learn more about this lazy evaluation, there's this lazy eval R pub, and I guess I was going to put something else in this link, which is just repeated currently. So I'm just going to delete this. So at some point, I will write something else that will talk more about this, but I do not have a link for you currently. So, thank you. We have time for a few questions. So there are people with mics who will run to you as quickly as possible and ask you a question.
Hadley, would you mind going to the slides about table package?
Sure.
I mean, you said that the interface of R is in some point not clean enough, and you want to have something else. Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons is that R uses partial matching. But if you're going to do... So the thing that you said is if you use the dollar sign, then you're on the side of interactive analysis. And that's fine. And if you go to the programming side, you should use double bracket notation, and you're also on the safe side. So there is something in R that's already... has the programming mechanism, so you could move your red line to the right-hand side when using double brackets, of course.
Yeah.
The other point is, I just forgot it, I think.
I think, the thing that was most frustrating, I think, like there's this tension between, there's this clear tension between interactive exploration and programming, and it's not kind of possible to always say like I'm being interactive or I'm being programming. There are some things in BaseR like the dollar sign versus the double square brackets. I think some of it is also just an educational thing. The other thing is like, because I am this kind of, I've lost my utopian, because I am this utopian, like, it turns out that this is actually a really terrible idea because lots of people rely on the fact that a missing column returns null, and so this is currently probably breaking hundreds of CRAN packages and we'll be like making that less aggressive very, very shortly. So some of this stuff, like, the other thing is it's difficult to do the right thing without experimenting. And like experimenting, the role of BaseR is not to experiment with stuff. It's to take like proven, well-known technologies and make them like stable over time. Whereas I'm like, feel like I can kind of experiment a little bit more, though that's getting like increasingly hard as more people use my packages. So, you know, please don't use my packages so I can experiment more. Have another question up the back?
Yeah. So while I shamelessly use your packages, there's always the trade-off between efficiency and the elegance. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are about how sometimes all these very elegant solutions can take a lot of resources.
Yeah, so I think when you think about doing a data analysis, there's like two bottlenecks, basically. There's your brain, right, and then there's your computer. And for like most of the analysis I do, and I think legitimately the most analysis that most people do, the bottleneck is your brain, right? You cannot literally like think fast enough to keep up with the computer. The challenge is like, what is the right thing to do? Once you've figured out the right thing to do, it's relatively, it takes relatively little time. You know, that's not true in every domain, and certainly as your data gets bigger, the computer becomes more and more of a bottleneck. So I am absolutely like most interested in empowering humans, not necessarily making the computer fast. Although, like as I kind of learn more about, you know, I can program in C++ now, and I can write stuff that's more efficient. And as my sort of team at RStudio grows, I hope we can focus more on, you know, I want you to have the best, in the long run, I want you to have the best of both worlds, both the elegance and performance. There's like fundamentally some trade-offs there, but there's still a lot more performance that you could eke out of these elegant approaches. Another question?
So one of the themes at the Bioconductor Developer Day last week was that there's a sort of tension between the traditional bioconductor workflows, which are heavily built on S4, mm-hmm. and workflows built on dplyr and some of your packages. So there wasn't really a clear resolution of how to reconcile these, but I just wonder whether you have any thoughts.
I mean, my thoughts are basically like list columns provide a nice way of resolving that. Like data frames are just such a powerful way of keeping related things together. That like they're fundamentally kind of vectorized, so you can say, you know, like in the approach I showed you, like subset, find me all of the rows with a bad RMSC, and everything's just carried along for the ride. If you have all these like vectors just floating around in your global environment, when you change one, you have to remember to change all the others, and that's like tedious and error prone. So I'm a huge believer in like data frames. Basically, part of that is just like I don't work with biological data. There are all sorts of like different constraints and different problems there that I'm not aware of, and I, you know, don't have to care about. So this is not like I don't claim to be solving like the world's problems, but this is just like in my experience, this seems to be a pretty solid way of storing your data. So.
We have now a wealth of different object-oriented systems in R, and what do you think what is most compatible with the tidyverse and what is not?
Yes, there are many different ways of doing object-oriented programming in R. I personally believe for most problems in R, like S3, is the best fit because it just does. It's very, very simple. It's like the simplest object-oriented system that might possibly work, and that turns out, in my experience, to be the most useful. I think there's some, there's this, I don't know if I can kind of explain this clearly, but I think one definition for like scripting languages is that in scripting languages, you tend to not create your own data structures. You tend to rely on a few built-in data structures. And one of the things that makes R really, really powerful and useful is that the built-in data structures it provides, data frames and lists and vectors, are really, really well suited to the problem domain of data analysis. R is not so good at creating new families of objects that work in exactly the same way as the built-in objects. So just generally, I think my experience is, like, when you're using R, you want to, like, work with it rather than fighting it. And to me, generally, working with R means, like, sticking stuff in a data frame. You're more likely to have an enjoyable time if you do that, rather than creating some complex new object. Although, you know, the bioconductor is the counterexample where there's just, it's a very different domain, and a lot of people invested a lot of time into making these really rich, powerful objects. So, you know, I don't think there's one right answer, but in my experience, start with S3, and if that's too limiting, then learn something else. I've got one. Okay.
Thank you for the inspiring talk. So yesterday there was a session about teaching R for beginners, and one issue that was raised was the conflict between, let's call it, the tidyverse and the base R. Also, I think it would be true about the base R graphics and grid/ggplot too. And I would like to know what your thoughts about when we are teaching new people coming to the community, who are not programmers necessarily. What would be, in your opinion, a good path? So, should they start base, go deplier?
So if you want like an unbiased answer based on research, then you should not ask me. I mean, clearly, like why would I bother developing these packages if I didn't think they were useful? Like, I personally believe that, I mean, I think when you're teaching, the one thing you should be thinking about is how can I get students to be effective data analysts as quickly as possible? And I think you can, I personally believe you can do that with ggplot2 and dplyr faster, partly because they don't have to care about all the details. Like, I think you start there, and then you want to later on go deeper, go into the details, understand how these things work. That is really, really important. But just to get someone, like, get that positive experience doing a data analysis, it's really fun, it's really enjoyable. Start with tools that enable them to do something where they're like, wow, that is awesome, as quickly as possible. And I don't care, like, whether, in your experience, that is base R or dplyr or lattice or ggplot2, whatever, but all I care about is that you're thinking about that for your students. How can I make them as effective as possible, as quickly as possible? Do, you know, be pragmatic, ruthlessly pragmatic.
Many of the things you mentioned come from functional programming or lessons from functional programming, but in the idea of a tidy API, one thing that struck me was that it's been kind of a personal, I had some pain around it, is that type classes, for mm-hmm. example, if there's something in the base R and you're adding functions, you should keep the same interface. It's nothing more frustrating to download a package that like mimics a distribution and then none of the functions follow the same, you know, interface guidelines or whatever. So I was just extending. What do you think about the idea of having like a tidy API also being, you know, if there exists a base R function or something that you want it to work with every other function?
Again, it comes to this back to sort of tension between being conservative and being utopian. Like, there's been a lot of really smart people put a lot of work into base R, but a lot of things have changed. And I think one thing I really enjoyed about Rick Becker's talk yesterday was just seeing, like, understanding the reasons that things in R are the way that they are, because of the reasons they were in S, and S, the computing environment from S is just so fundamentally different from today. So I think absolutely you want to look at base R, you want to look critically, like, is this stuff really useful? Does it still apply today? Yes, let's keep that. Let's keep all that hard work. But equally, we need to say, well, some things have just like fundamentally changed. And we need to think equally, like, do we want to copy this old API that that maybe doesn't apply so much anymore. And again, you know, I'm very much on the utopian end of, it's not perfect, I'm willing to like burn it down and start from scratch. And you just have to like understand that about me, where base R is much, much more conservative. And there's, you know, I don't think, like, being a utopian is not better than being a conservative, it's just a different set of trade-offs. And that's why, like, if you install a new version of ggplot2, maybe your old code, your old plots will break and you will like curse me for 15 minutes. But you just have to like, my hope is that just things are getting better overall, and a little bit of short-term pain is going to help you in the long run. Okay, thank you.